I'm Jim Bertel. On Sunday morning, U.S. President Donald Trump announced a U.S. military operation in northwest Syria successfully targeted and eliminated Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. AP's Sagar Magani has more.
Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is dead.
In a rare Sunday address here at the White House, the president says American intelligence found the Islamic State leader in northwestern Syria. Commandos stormed a compound a few miles from the Turkish border and chased him into a dead-end tunnel, where the president says a whimpering al-Baghdadi set off a suicide vest.
He died like a dog. He died like a coward.
Al-Baghdadi's killing is a big foreign policy win for a president already being criticized for pulling American troops back in Syria and facing impeachment proceedings at home. He's suggesting it's more significant than the Obama administration's takedown of Osama bin Laden. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Turkey's army says Kurdish fighters killed one Turkish soldier and wounded five others amid a shaky truce in northern Syria. The latest death brings its military death toll to 11 since the launch of its cross-border operation. A 150-hour truce brokered by Russia, allowing Syrian Kurdish fighters to complete their withdrawal, runs out Tuesday evening. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he wants a broad national unity government amid political deadlock over forming a government following last month's elections. Speaking to his cabinet, he says such a coalition is essential for Israel to face what he said were mounting security challenges around the region. Netanyahu's challenger, former Army Chief Benny Gantz, is currently trying to form a government after Netanyahu failed at his attempt. For news on the go, download the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. Thousands of Iraqi protesters stood fast in Baghdad's central Tahrir Square on Sunday, defying a bloody crackdown that killed scores over the weekend. Young men had erected barricades on a bridge leading to the capital's fortified green zone against security forces who continued to fire tear gas canisters towards them. At least 69 Iraqis were killed on Friday and Saturday and hundreds wounded as demonstrators clashed with security forces and militia groups. The U.S. chief peace negotiator for Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, met leaders of Kabul Sunday after arriving in the country on an unannounced visit. This is the first visit since President Donald Trump halted talks with Taliban insurgents on ending the Afghan war. Afghan officials say the results of last month's presidential election will be announced on November 14th. British police say three suspects who were arrested in the death of 39 people hidden in a shipping container have been released on bail. AP's Zaria Shackley has more.
Police in southeastern England said that a 38-year-old man, a 38-year-old woman, both from the northern English town of Warrington, and a 45-year-old man from Northern Ireland have been released after being questioned on suspicion of manslaughter and conspiracy to traffic people. The bodies were found early Wednesday in an industrial park in southeastern England. Essex police have charged the driver of the truck, 25-year-old Maurice Robinson of Northern Ireland, with 39 counts of manslaughter, conspiracy to traffic people, and conspiracy to assist unlawful immigration money laundering. Zaria Shakili, London.
Police in central Vietnam say they have taken forensic samples from residents who believe their family members may be among the 39 victims. Ivan Milat, one of Australia's worst convicted serial killers, has died in prison after spending 23 years behind bars. Reuters' Emma McCarthy reports.
One of Australia's worst convicted serial killers has died in prison, nearly 30 years after the backpacker murders for which he gained notoriety. Ivan Milat was serving seven consecutive life sentences after being convicted in 1996 for the killings of two Britons, three Germans and two Australians, in a case that made grim headlines around the world. He never admitted to murdering the young men and women, some of whom were sexually assaulted, shot or stabbed. Milat was also linked to several other unsolved missing persons cases and died under suspicion of having committed more crimes.
That's Reuters' Emma McCarthy reporting. California is bracing for extreme and potentially historic winds today as state officials in Northern California ordered the evacuation of at least 50,000 more people with a nearby wildfire continuing to burn. From Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We need to build morale. We need to build peace. So now, I don't think the opposition has changed as government, but what we're interested in and what is the president interested in is for the nation to be restored to peace, law and order. And we are committed to do that as government.
The Malawian president calls for dialogue with opponents to end the political crisis.
The problem, like I said, the government has to accept to open up a political space that the opposition party outside the country, they can kind of come back in the country and they can exercise their rights.
A Rwandan opposition leader calls for an independent inquiry into the disappearances and death of political opponents of the government.
We'll continue to agitate. I know that a number of sacrifices will have to be made. Some people may have to pay the ultimate price, you know, with their blood. But then if it is for the sake of the liberation of freeing of the people of Uganda so that we may have a better country to live in, so let it be.
And a Ugandan opposition leader calls for a convention to discuss strategies to end President Yoweri Museveni's rule. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Malawian President Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika is calling for a dialogue with civil society and opposition groups to resolve the prevailing political crisis, according to Information Minister Mark Botomani. The president, he said, made the announcement following his return home from the Russia-Africa summit held in Sochi. Human Rights Defenders Forum, a political pressure group, has been organizing a series of demonstrations across the country demanding the ouster or firing of Dr. Justice Jane Ansah, chairperson of the Electoral Commission. For more about the call for dialogue, I reach Malawian Information Minister Mark Botomani.
No, it is true. The president was in Sochi, Russia, and he returned home on Saturday. And when he landed, he made that very strong statement. And at the airport when he just came, calling upon all opposition parties, opposition leaders, as well as the civil society groups and other warring parties to come on the round table and to discuss issues that have been disturbing Malawi for the past few months. And our position is that exactly what the president has said now. He's opened up to anybody who is interested to build Malawi or to rebuild Malawi to come forward so that they can, sit on their own table together.
Is the call for the peace talks or dialogue an admission that there's a problem that needs to be fixed in Malawi?
No, I mean, this is not the first time the president has admitted that there is a problem, which has always been there, that has caused havoc in many places, especially the major cities of Malawi. He has said it before, and he has always called, for calm. He has called for people to desist from, damaging the reputation of the country and therefore disturbing peace. But now he's just put it, he's just emphasized it more with the need, for the warring parties to come together and find a solution because he has said that peace is more important than the differences that we have.
When does he want this dialogue to happen, and do you anticipate the civil society groups and the opposition to agree to sit down with the talks, despite the fact that some opposition groups are challenging the outcome of the election in court, for which reason the demonstration is going on, demanding the resignation of the chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission?
Now, as to when this will happen, I cannot tell, because I'm sure there are some processes that need to be followed. These will be very high-level, engagements, Obviously participated by the president himself, or perhaps he might appoint some people that he may want to, he may trust, so that they can engage in the process. So that I cannot tell as to how, to when. Now, as to whether the other parties, that is the civil society groups and the opposition parties, will heed the call, that is neither here nor there, because we cannot force them to come on the round table. But taking it from what they have commented before, I am aware that at some point last week, the former leader of the opposition, who is the president of the NHLCP, also expressed the need, for the country to come together, the willingness, to participate in such a dialogue. Now that the head of state himself has expressed it and he has emphasized it like he has done before, I'm sure the opposition parties will be willing to participate. Now, yes, I know the matters are in court, but that is not a matter for discussion. We're all waiting for the court to put up their verdict. But you see, these are the most important thing is for people to come together and find a solution for all the challenges that we've had. I don't think people can be saying they can be waiting for the court before they sit down and look at the solutions that can be there. I'm sure that's the way to go.
What if the opposition groups, including HRDC, that has been organizing the demonstrations demanding the resignation of Dr. Justice Jane Ansah, the chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission, say one of the things they want to resolve this impasse is for her to be fired or forced to step down. Will it be acceptable to the president in this dialogue that he called with the opposition and civil society groups?
On the government side, we have not seen any merit in the demand for the resignation of Dr. Jane Ansah. But you see what? This should not be something that should preoccupy us. Then the demands, by the opposition and the HRDC should not, overshadow the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is we need to build Malawi. We need to build peace. So now, I don't think our position has changed as government, but what we are interested in and what is the president interested in is for the nation to be restored to peace, law and order. And we are committed to do that as government.
Mark Botomani is the Malawian Information Minister. He spoke with me from the Egyptian resource city of Sharm el-Sheikh. The leader of the Rwandan opposition Unified Democratic Forces is calling on the international community to urge the government to launch an independent investigation into the disappearances and assassinations of opposition supporters. Victoire Ingabire says the authorities are yet to apprehend those behind the disappearances and murder of opponents of the governing Rwandan Patriotic Front, or RPF. Ms. Ingabire tells me that political space in Rwanda should also be open to all citizens with dissenting views to freely operate without any intimidation or harassment.
No, the political space is not yet open in Rwanda because the opposition is not easy to be free to operate freely inside Rwanda if you are opposition. I can give an example. Since I was released, I lost 3 members from a political party. There are 2 disappearances and there are 2 assassinations. How you can say that the political space is open up if the opposition members are killed?
Have you called for an independent investigation into the disappearance or what you say is assassination or murder of your supporters?
Of course, we ask the international community, especially the donor country of Rwanda, to ask the government of Rwanda to accept the international investigation regarding this killing or this disappearance of members of opposition in Rwanda.
Talking about the political space, the Green Party president or presidential candidate has been campaigning freely. Recently, when you had elections, an independent candidate crisscrossed the country campaigning freely. So why are you saying the political space has been narrowed or politicians opposing the government have not been allowed to operate freely across the country when these people campaigned before the elections?
If we talk about political parties, we have so many political parties in Rwanda, Green Party and the other, I think we have more than 11 parties. But all parties, they are in the same basket as the ruling political party. So you can say that they are leading the opposition political party. But if you are leading in opposition, they consider you as the enemy of the country. That is the very problem we have inside Rwanda. Second thing, you can't have the election that the Green Party participated in this election. It is a sign that there is a political space in Rwanda. It is not true because, of course, every 7 years we have election in Rwanda, but everybody knows that the election has nothing to do with the democracy.
Why are you saying so? Didn't Rwandans overwhelmingly vote for President Kagame because of his leadership style and because of infrastructure development, which a lot of people are saying it has become the envy of a lot of Africans on the continent, and that because he's doing so well, because their lives have been improved, because poverty is sharply reduced in Rwanda, that is why they voted overwhelmingly for him?
You know, that is really the problem we have. I know that the many countries in Africa or outside Africa, they praise the government of President Kagame for the achievement in the development. But the achievement in development, it is not the reason to abuse the human rights. It is not the reason to refuse your people to express their minds. Because in Rwanda, if you want these people express their minds, they can't. They are feared because if you do it, they put you in prison. If people are not free, you cannot really that you can achieve sustainable development because we need freedom to express ourselves. And then we can really have the sustainable development. If they talk about the development in the country, it is also something that we can discuss about it because it is true, we have a beautiful and a clean capital Kigali. We have a beautiful streets, we have a beautiful building, but it is the only in Kigali. The development we need is the development that really achieve all Rwanda's people.
Some supporters of the ruling party are saying that some of you opposition leaders are conniving with people outside the country or in neighboring countries trying to destabilize the country, and that instead of coming up with constructive criticisms to improve and move the country forward, you are rather conniving with people to destabilize the country and make Rwanda ungovernable. How do you react to this?
No, that's the problem. What I said, the government has to accept to open up a political space that the opposition party outside the country, they can come back in the country and they can exercise their rights inside the Rwanda. I don't suppose someone wants, for example, to use the war as the solution of the political problem in Rwanda. But on the other side, the government has to accept us to give up the space to the political that they can come back in the country. The solution is in the hand of the government of Kagame.
Victoire Ingabire is the leader of the Rwandan opposition Unified Democratic Forces. She spoke with me from the capital, Kigali. Ugandan main opposition groups say they will be working together to wrestle power from President Yoweri Museveni and his governing party, the National Resistance Movement, or NRM. The groups say they will use the Declaration of the Year of Action as a tool to democratically remove the president from power. This after opposition activist Dr. Chisa Besigye announced a soon-to-be-organized convention with the sole objective of coming up with strategies to end President Museveni's 33-year rule. To learn more about the plans by the opposition groups, I reached Patrick Oboy Amurias, leader of the main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, FDC.
Well, we have been in this struggle for a long time now as a party for 14 years, struggling using elections and activism to bring change in the leadership of Uganda. And so we have had campaigns after campaigns. We've participated in elections that have been stolen. And late last year, we, together with the People's Government, declared 2019 the year of action. And so we've been preparing for all this time for this action. And the other day, Dr. Chisa Besigye, on behalf of us all, have called on all pro-democracy forces, including other pressure groups and other political parties, to join this campaign that is meant to free the people of Uganda from the yoke of the dictatorship of Mr. Museveni.
What do you mean by the year of action, and what does it entail?
This year of action is going to see us carrying out activities. Of course, this declaration is meant to stop Mr. Museveni and his cronies appearing on the ballot paper of 2021, because he has in the past shown that he is not interested in free and fair elections, and that he can never be removed from power using a mere piece of paper, as he describes it. And so, really, the year of action 2019 is a declaration of actions that are non-violent, that are intended to rally the people of Uganda to rise up against the regime. Things that have caused us to call for a national conference where we are going to not only discuss security, but also lack of respect for human rights.
But so when is this national conference? And don't you think that it will undermine what the government says are plans by the opposition to destabilize the country, to forcefully take over power?
We are not going to take over power by force. The opposition and the people of Uganda, indeed, who feel insecure in different ways, whose rights have been trampled upon in many ways, are being called upon. This is a call for them to take the authority of their own destiny. And so we are having a conference. We cannot wait for Mr. Museveni to resolve some of the failures that he has gone through these 34 years of his regime in power. And so we think that this is an expression of a vote of no confidence in the system that runs this country today. And we are saying, well, we must do something, otherwise we are all going to get finished.
So how do you intend confronting the government? Because the government has said that every agitation, every demonstration or protest you have organized have turned violent, and you have clashed with police, destroying public property. How are you going to engage the government to ensure that things are run smoothly and that there's no instability and political disturbance in Uganda?
Very often, really, we have carried our activities without violence. What precipitates violence is the actions of the police. Many of our activities have been broken up. The regime would not want people to assemble. They do not want us to inform the people about the failures of the regime and what needs to be done in order for these failures to be mitigated. And so we continue to be in this cycle. We are actually the victim. The police is the tormentor. And so I don't think that we exercise violence in any way. It's actually the police that has continued to attack its people, the people of Uganda, the common citizen of Uganda. But we believe that this is our country. And so we'll continue to agitate. I know that a number of sacrifices will have to be made. Some people may have to pay the ultimate price, you know, with their blood. But then if it is for the sake of the liberation of freeing of the people of Uganda, so that we may have a better country to live in, so let it be.
Patrick Oboi Amuriat is the leader of the Ugandan main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Meanwhile, opposition parliamentarian Akol Anthony says Ugandans are disappointed in the ability of the administration to effectively manage the affairs of the country. He adds that despite repeated promises, the president has yet to jumpstart the economy, to create jobs for the youth, to sharply reduce the high unemployment rate. Anthony, who is the Shadow Minister for Finance, Planning and Economic Development, stopped by the VOA studios to talk to me about the latest Ugandan political development.
Looking at the current economic situation in Uganda, as a Shadow Economic or Finance Minister, is there hope for the people of Uganda?
Well, the problem now in the country, there is sugar-coated development to the extent that the government officials, they use how to manipulate the figures so that they show to the rest of the world that the country is growing.
What do you mean sugar-coated?
I mean, the figures lie, because if you transform the figures into human life and how people are facing problems in the country, there are a lot of poor people than the few rich people. So when somebody talks about GDP, the money that the few individuals who have money, the few of them, it is distributed on every Ugandan. But at the end of the day, you find there is a lot of poverty and people are suffering, and there is a lot of disparity in terms of the regions.
I understand that, but what is the alternative? What structures can be put in place to reverse this or improve the other living conditions, the living conditions actually, of those who are marginalized or those who are not in government to enjoy, like what you just described?
The most important thing will be aligning the development issues to the budget of the country. But all this time, I have been Shadow Minister of Finance since 2016. To date, you advise the government to make sure that they align the budget according to the development goal of the country. But they don't do it. They look at where exactly can they get money in the corruption issues, and then they push more money into it. That's why the country's development is not balanced. You realize that more than 73% of Ugandans, the poor Ugandans, are from northern Uganda and eastern Uganda. These are regions which are now marginalized. But for a real sustainable development, you need to leave nobody behind. And if you've been following Ugandan issues for a long time, from 2016, the president was talking about the middle-income economy, that Uganda will reach a middle-income economy by 2020. But as I talk now, whether he's addressing the country in any other gathering, from the president to the cabinet ministers to any other person who is in the government, you will never hear them talking about that, because it is impossible.
I understand that, but where does this leave the ordinary people of Uganda, the poor people who are left behind as you describe them? What do they do? If even the opposition people, a shadow minister like you, is not making inroads to help them, where do this leave them?
Well, the issue has been about the human rights violations. Ugandans have been, you know, rendered hopeless because of the fear. First of all, there is no freedom of space for speaking, for gathering, and you can't mobilize the citizens to talk about the problem happening in the country. But the advantage we have now is that the young people are coming up now, and they're saying enough is enough. After around 34 years of one man's rule, and you don't see anything coming that creates hope for the country, that's why you now see young generation have come up, those who were born in the same regime, and then they decided and say, no, we have to now bring power back to us.
I understand that some of you, the opposition people, including parliamentarians, including yourself, have been organizing some of these protests that turned violent. They attack, supposedly, the security forces who are there to maintain law and order, just to destabilize the country, make it ungovernable, so you can take power that way. That is the position of the government. How do you react to that?
The reaction is simple. We have embarked on mobilizing the young generation and Ugandans to understand that it is possible. Because the problem we were having, people had already given up. But we're wakening them up. They now have seen that it is possible. Because we have had some by-elections in the country where, despite all the military, the police, the militias, all the brutality taking place, you will see young Ugandans now coming up and saying, no, we need to have power now back to the people, the citizens of Uganda.
Akol Anthony is a Ugandan opposition parliamentarian. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C.
This week, put this on your to-do list. Have fun. Listen to Music Time in Africa. Hi there, I'm Heather Maxwell. Join me this Sunday for 55 minutes of sublime, commercial-free Pan-African music. Song of the Week comes out of Nigeria by Zlatan. It's called Bonlale. My vintage tune, recorded in the early 1970s, is Karanga storyteller, kalimba player Stephen Gumbo. His baboon story will fascinate and entertain you for sure. Also meet the most famous female voice from Mozambique you've probably never heard of, Mingash. I sat down with her in Maputo for this great interview.
Elisa Dominguez Salatiel Jamis.
So, to do, listen to Music Time in Africa at 1505 or 20500 Universal Time.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, the Ghanaian government has terminated a contract for energy production and distribution that the U.S. Millennium Challenge Corporation has backed. For VOA, Mavis Autry has more from Washington.
The cancelled contract follows a forensic audit into finances of Power Distribution Services, the company that has signed an agreement to take over power supply and distribution from the southern parts of the country. The audit showed that PDS owned by local and foreign companies failed to acquire proper financial guarantees. The consortium had presented guarantees from an insurance company in Qatar that appeared to have been issued without proper approval or financial backing. A Ghanaian consortium holds 51% of the PDH shares. Manila Electrical Company Limited, a Philippine company, has 30% of the shares, while A Energia from Angola holds 19%. Kofi Damwa is a chief spokesperson for the Ministry of Energy. He says the financial guarantees were key conditions for transferring assets and facilities from the Electricity Company of Ghana to PDS.
That gave some security to the government of Ghana that in the event that the concessionaire was unable to live up to their financial obligations, we had an alternative to fall on. Thus, if it turns out that it is invalid, or voided or fraudulently procured, then it warrants, in the opinion of the government of Ghana, the dissolution of the entire contract.
Damwa says the government followed due process before ending the concession agreement with PDS. He says the cancellation of the contract will not distract the electrical supply, since the Electricity Company of Ghana was fully in charge of power distribution in the country at a time of PDS suspension.
It's the opinion of the government of Ghana that documentation submitted before the transfer of assets occurred for the PDS deal to become effective were troublesome, to say the least. As such, government holds the opinion that the transfer is voidable and has been voided.
The Millennium Challenge Corporation and the Ghanaian government signed the Power Supply Compact in 2014. The deal involved nearly $500 million fund from the MCCE, which is an independent aid agency of the U.S. government. The goal of the deal was to achieve lasting economic growth and reduce poverty through increased private sector investment in key industries. After Ghana cancelled the deal, the MCCE said it will cancel a planned $190 million grant for the PDS concession. However, the agency says the U.S. government will continue to implement the first tranche of funds of $308 million U.S. dollars. The money will continue to support improvements to the infrastructure of Ghana's southern electrical distribution network, increase reliability and power access to key markets, and advance energy efficiency programs. Reporting for the VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Washington.
And Tunisia's newly elected president, Kais Saied, received support from the moderate Islamist party Ennahda, which won the recent parliamentary election. Saied delivered a message of hope for the country, vowing to fight corruption, extremism, and to protect freedoms, including women's rights. Sarah Yarks, a fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Program, spoke with viewers Mohamed El-Shenawi about the needed steps to take to resolve the many challenges facing Tunisia.
We really don't know what concrete steps he's going to propose, and I think we really need to remember that his main issue, fighting corruption, is outside the purview of the presidency. The president is responsible for foreign policy, defense, and national security, but we really haven't heard much from him yet on what he plans to do in those arenas that he is actually going to have control over.
The new president is a constitutional law professor by trade with no real experience in foreign policy. Do you expect any major changes in Tunisian foreign policy?
Overall, I think he'll probably stay the same course as the previous president. Tunisia has been largely neutral in most cases, but there are a couple of issues that I think will be interesting to watch. The first is that he has expressed some concern over foreign aid for civil society, and this might in fact weaken the Tunisian relationship with the United States and the European partners who provide this assistance. So we will see if he does shift his position towards these partners at all. And second, he's been much more strident in his positions against Israel. He's called any dealing with Israel treason, and has said that while he welcomes Jewish tourists to Tunisia, no one with an Israeli passport. This is a far more harsh stance than the previous administration had taken.
Article 98 of the Tunisian constitution provides that the candidate of the party or coalition with the largest number of seats in the parliament shall be assigned to form the government within a month. Would another party be able to form a new government in Tunisia?
Ennahda seems confident that it will be able to form a new government. Whatever the end government is, it will certainly be more fragmented than either of the government of Prime Minister Assid or Prime Minister Shahid, particularly because the second largest party, Kalb Tunis, is not going to be in the government. But interestingly, Ennahda announced yesterday that it intends to choose a prime minister from within its own party, which is something that people didn't really expect it to do. They thought we might see a consensus candidate, someone from outside Ennahda. They've said instead they're going to put forward a candidate from Ennahda, which may make it easier in some senses to form the government.
But Ennahda party reached a consensus in the past, enabling a smooth transition after the revolution. However, the potential partners in forming the new government are raising conditions like specific ministerial portfolios and clear programs for reform. Would that lead to a smooth coalition?
I think it's too early to tell what exactly the coalition is going to look like. And it's certainly possible that Ennahda will be able to hand out some key ministerial portfolios to some of the smaller parties, but still maintain an overall coherent policy for the government. I think the bigger question is, how is President Said's policy priorities, how will they actually mesh with those of Ennahda, particularly when it comes to Said's desire for more direct democracy, which would actually require amending the constitution to devolve power away from the parliament. This is something Ennahda would likely reject. So I think we are going to see some clashes between the presidency and the government once the government is formed.
But why we are not hearing any programs to fix the economy, which is the biggest challenge since the revolution?
I think very sort of disappointingly, none of the candidates inside himself has a clear plan to do this. While he made corruption and addressing the economy the issues of his campaign, he hasn't put forward any concrete ideas. He has said that he's sort of waiting for others to drive that idea, and the government will be in charge of doing that. And Ennahda is going to have a very difficult task of coming up with real concrete policies to improve the situation, particularly related to youth unemployment. We don't know what that's going to be yet. We're going to have to see what that is. But if they're unable to do it, they're going to end up with a very frustrated Tunisian public.
Sarah Yax is a fellow at the Carnegie Middle East program. She spoke with viewers Mohammed El Shanawi from Washington. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect a flashback with music from the continent. You're hearing from Vanessa MD with Niroge, and then Ahab Amir featuring DJ Soul. Lemandouche will come next. Angelique Kidjo follows with Wombolombo, and then Pato Ranking featuring Diamond will end with I Love You Die. Wakiomba unichape game kongoto jamani sielewi.
Kofi. We mwana umenguso, ulishindaga vikwazo.
عمري غاب شخصية وخا يكون فيك جمال عبلة تكوني حورية ويلي 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 ويلي
Making money was the plan, and we go get on Paja Gabbana. Girl, I always owe you down, anytime that you're feeling down. Mama say, girl, make you settle down. Tell her, say, I don't get you down. Put the smile, make you know the frown. Say, no one can pull you down. So me sing, say, win, win, win. Win, win, win. We go there. Yeah.
chibude. Do kana joni taga bebe, utam tam, shoy naga doze. Babu yuma shapam timbeze, zaga zigi zigi. Oje, mtoto na mabigi biki. Oje, kitanda nini kwichi kwichi. Oje, asa tuki jigi jiki. Oh, no she de make me losing control.
Chidima with Falling in Love. We're able to sneak that in there. That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's Woman's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. SADC, a regional economic group in Southern Africa, initiated a plan last week that may have repercussions in Africa. SADC announced that it was calling on the Western countries to remove their crippling economic sanctions in Zimbabwe and promoted the notion that the economic tone down in Zimbabwe was due not so much to corruption and economic mismanagement, a preferred argument of Western countries. Sanctions by themselves are not illegal in terms of UN Charter principles. The Chapter 7 of the UN Charter provides sanctions as one of the tools available to the Security Council to compel delinquent states to comply with its decision short of war. And in the past, the Security Council did impose comprehensive sanctions on a number of countries around the world. However, in the 1980s, civil society groups began to complain that United Nations economic sanctions was having a more serious impact on the poor members of society rather than those who are making the policies that demands the use of sanctions. The response from the Council was to resort to what became known as targeted sanctions, that is, those with greater responsibility for the actions being criticized by the Council. Later on, it became even more difficult for the Security Council to adopt sanctions because of disagreement in the Security Council among the five prominent members. The Western countries' response was to begin the practice of unilateral sanctions and then insisting that their unilateral sanctions should have extraterritorial impact. This has caused trouble among many legal scholars, and many countries have criticized those practices. But the fact of the matter is, because of the widespread network of Western banking system and its economic power, they have been very effective. For example, recently in the Gulf, an Iranian vessel was seized by the British on the grounds that Iran was not complying with European sanctions on Syria, even though Iran has no obligation to comply with that decision. Now, in terms of Zimbabwe, what SADC is trying to do is to let the world know that the Western countries should assume their own responsibility. They cannot just say it is due to question of mismanagement of the economy and corruption. They should own up. Similar question was raised in terms of Venezuela recently when the Western countries was arguing the problem was mismanagement and corruption. Will SADC succeed? It is kind of doubtful. Do not forget that year after year, the General Assembly has called on the United States to lift its sanctions on Cuba. Even though during the time of the Obama administration there was a relaxation, they're all back in full force. But it is important to have this debate as it was in the 1980s. But there must also be an awareness that one in Zimbabwe itself, the opposition to the government would want it to be known that the economic downturn was more because of corruption and mismanagement. Secondly, one must take into account that the white minority groups in southern Africa have effective lobbies in Western chancelleries, and they will be fighting against any relaxation of economic sanction in Zimbabwe unless their goals are met, full compensation for lands taken by the government or return of the land. But it's important that SADC has raised a debate which should be debated fully in Africa and internationally, because we could not go on with this kind of bizarre sanction system where people impose sanctions but are not willing to own up that the deterioration of the economy is due to the sanctions. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Shaogang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, an army of sheep led by a lion can defeat an army of lions led by a sheep. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Jim.